Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your public adversary, private pal of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
It's bad bitch o'clock, yeah, it's thick 30. I've been through a lot, but I'm still flirty. Is everybody back up in the building? It's been a minute, tell me how you're healing. Cause I'm about to get into my feelings.
If you are feeling exuberant, if you are feeling uplifted, if you're feeling joy, you are feeling Lizzo. That is what you are feeling. That was About Damn Time that we came in with. About Damn Time is the single from the new Lizzo album, which is called Special. We've never done a Lizzo episode, or at least not fully dedicated to Lizzo. So on this week's podcast, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about her new album. We're going to talk about the meta narratives that are surrounding the discourse on the album. Lindsay Zoledz is going to be here. Justin Charity is going to be here. And we're going to talk about all things Lizzo and all things empowerment and whether empowerment is compatible with great pop music. And sometimes I think people think it's not, but maybe it is. The answer might surprise you. At the end of the episode, we're going to do a quick segment, and you guys will hopefully ride with me on this. Richard Taruskin is a very important classical music critic and academic, passed away recently. We're going to talk about Taruskin's role in evolving the discourse on classical music in the public sphere. Taruskin was a professor for many years. I read him in college, and also he used to write for the Sunday Arts and Leisure section back in the day when I started writing for the Times. So he had both an academic and a public profile. And I think a lot of the arguments that he was making about classical music criticism will be very familiar to you from the kinds of conversations that we have on this show about pop musicians. So stick around. Will Robin is going to call in to talk to me about Richard Taruskin. But first, we're going to talk about Lizzo's Special this week with two people who have written thoughtful exegeses on this pop text of summer 2022. First, Lindsay Zoledz is here. Lindsay, bienvenue.
Hello.
It's hot.
It's hot. I don't love it. I don't feel like a Lizzo song today, I'll say.
No, I hear that. And actually, I have some thoughts on that because it's hot. I'm just going to be vulnerable and say I've had a bad week. And I was listening to the Lizzo album this morning and I was like, do I feel better? Maybe I feel better. Checking in from the Midwest Bureau. It's Justin Charity from The Ringer. Justin.
Yeah, you know, it's Wisconsin, so it's not hot. It's actually nice, cool.
Yeah, what's a temp check?
Mid-70s, baby.
What's a humidity check out there?
The humidity is worse than usual, I'd say. But okay. It's still better than where you guys are at. So.
All right, something so light, as someone said to me recently. Something so light. Okay, let's come in hot. Why is there so much anxiety about Lizzo takes in the world? And at least a small part of this, we can go back to the coverage of the first Lizzo album. Rawia Kamir from Pitchfork wrote a review. Lizzo responded to that review. We talked about it on a clapback edition of Popcast. Very good episode. Go back and listen to that. There does seem to be, in general, some anxiety around Lizzo takes just in the big picture. Why is that? What does that reflect?
Her music is what I think I have used the phrase, and I've seen it used around a lot, well-intentioned, and has this function of serving positivity in the lives of the listener, potentially, which, John, I do want to get to, if it really had its medicinal properties for you
it really did.
That way.
Okay. Keep in mind, I'm underslept for about 5 days running, so six of one, half dozen of the other, really.
Yeah, but I think there's something in the way that Lizzo's music is discussed and Lizzo's celebrity, something separate from her music, of the intention versus the actual critical quality of the music, really. And I think that was something that came up a lot in the criticism of the first album. There was sort of a hesitance to really go in. I think when, and even Rawia's review that Lizzo responded to was very even-handed and I would say more of a mixed review than a negative review. It was in that climate of artists seeing any type of criticism at all as a rebuke to everything they do and just sort of shutting down this conversation that had more nuance on it than something being good or bad. So I think that made people skittish in some ways to have more of a substantial critique of the actual music itself. But I think that there is this sense that she is trying to be this force for good and positivity and confidence in people's lives. And that if you do have some sort of issue with that or are criticizing the songs on an artistic level, that you're sort of being a killjoy and missing the point of it.
And also, in addition to being a killjoy, you're also suggesting that that set of emotions is maybe not valid. And also the person who's delivering that set of emotions is not valid. Like, this is interesting because there's sometimes I feel like we have a lot of conversations about critiquing difficult art from people who are exceedingly negative in their art. And this is actually the kind of the opposite thing where someone is so exceedingly positive. And I don't hear as much complaining about people saying, oh, someone who's exceedingly negative, you can dismiss them. I mean, I don't agree with that, but most people are kind of like, well, that's fine. But with someone's extremely positive and then you end up dismissing it, then yes, it's killjoy to the 10th power. And also, what's wrong with you? I do feel a little bit of that. Justin, are you feeling uplifted by the Lizzo record this year?
Uplifted is stretching it. I do think that part of the riddle with Lizzo, right, is that she's corny. Just as a celebrity and as a musician, she's corny. And I'm saying that in a sort of value neutral way right now. I think we're used to sort of when you engage with an artist who has a youthful fan base, right, and who is sort of, it's definitionally what the kids are listening to. You know, when an artist is like that, you're usually used to engaging with an artist who on some level is interested in and invested in some definition of cool. Lizzo is weird because she's not cool. She's not even arguably cool. Like, her music is so transparently and totally corny and theater kiddy. And you know what I mean? I think that's what can make it hard sometimes. And that's what sort of lends itself to what Lindsay's talking about, right? This sense of like, if you criticize it, you're missing the point. That to me is the trickiest thing to writing about Lizzo, is that sense of like, you're not writing about something that's popping because it's cool. It's almost like Lizzo works for a lot of people on a level that has nothing to do with cool, if that makes sense.
Okay, but I want to just pick up on something you said, and you talked about this in your review. And we should also upfront say, Justin, I felt like your review was maybe more positive, more embracing of Lizzo and the album. And Lindsay, yours was a little bit more skeptical of it. But you mentioned just now like a younger fan base, and you also mentioned that in your review, Justin. I don't know if I totally agree with that. I actually feel like the fan base might be more millennials, middle-aged women. Like, my main takeaway from the album, and I've had different reactions to it the different times I've listened to it from a critique aesthetic perspective, but my main takeaway from the album is that these are catchphrases first, song second. These are event records. This is, damn, we need a birthday song. Let's have a song called Birthday Girl. We want to have an inclusivity anthem. Let's have a song called Everybody's Gay. I love you, bitch. Great universal sentiment for friend groups or loving yourself. They feel like catchphrase backwards. And I feel like that to me feels not so much like a younger fan base as maybe an older fan base. And I was surprised to see you talking about a younger fan base because that's not really how it resonates for me. I feel like I know people my age or, God forbid, older. I don't know if anyone on the planet is older than me, but if anyone is, I can see them really resonating with the record.
I actually agree with all that. And I could have maybe illuminated this a bit more in the piece, right? But it's like, there's a line where I talk about it, like, she can curse all she wants, but you just sound like you're listening to music for middle schoolers because of the kind of, again, that theater kid pose she strikes. But at the same time, like paradoxically at the same time, Lizzo is so distinctly old millennial. Like, she's very much that hashtag sensibility, that dope AF. Like, all the stuff that only old millennials say is what Lizzo is herself. And I think that's what leads to that contradiction, right? That dope AF, like, it her fan base is either people who are 10 or it's people who are like
trying to talk to the youth, like Steve Buscemi, how do you do, feller high schooler kind of vibes.
Yeah, exactly. It feels like her fan base is either old millennials or it is 10-year-olds. And that, so I agree with you, actually.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of Birthday Girl, which probably could get played at a 10-year-old's birthday or a 40-year-old's birthday. Let's go. You got it. Lindsay, when you hear records like this, like Birthday Girl and so on and so forth, what's dead inside you that you don't love this song?
I don't have a birthday of my own.
Are you a, like a leap year birthday? No.
No.
Because, and again, so just to circle back, I've had a bumpy week. And this morning I was like, I'm going to listen to the Lizzo album one more time in preparation for this. I got to be honest. There were some moments where I was like, I should be like working out to this music. Like I should feel like a genuinely like uplifted, more positive, you know, I don't know if it's just the chord progressions or the key in which certain songs are, but I definitely felt like this morning. And maybe because I was sleepy and a little bit vulnerable and allowed myself to take in the optimism. Is that the fulcrum there? It's like, you're either on the, I accept the optimism or I reject the optimism. Is that kind of where the Lizzo art debate lives?
Maybe. And it's interesting that like I have that experience with some of her songs, just not Birthday Girl in particular. I think as an aside, just because it feels like Katy Perry did this already with the song Birthday, which is to me a superior and top tier Katy Perry song. So get little hints of Katy Perry's Prism from this album, but that's, we can table that for now.
A rare Katy Perry endorsement on Popcast.
Well,
except for Karen. For Karen. Yeah.
Shout out to Karen. Yeah, I feel that way about Damn Time, the single, which is a song that sort of won me over in spite of being, I think I called it Lizzo by numbers. There's a flute solo. She says bitch at the end of a line. Like, you know, she's hitting all the hashtags, as Charity would put it. But when it works, it works. I think that was another line that I just used in my review that also kind of suggests that when it is working, maybe it is immune to looking deeper and looking to that critique. I think the songs that work on this record and on her last record might be different. You know, like the level of corniness, is to use another one of Charity's words here. That threshold is going to be different for every song. And so the ones that I think it just, if it hits you and it makes you feel good, I do think that's what she's out to do. But maybe just for me, and maybe I'm like incredibly cynical as a professional music critic, perhaps, although maybe not. I think that for me, when it doesn't work and when the elements aren't coming together, it does feel extra cloying and suspect for me. I can suspend my disbelief for a song like About Damn Time, or It Sounds Like John for Birthday Girl. And then the moment the spell breaks, I'm kind of like, what's really going on here? And why do I feel like I'm in an Old Navy commercial, you know?
And as a sidebar, pants should not cost $14.99. That's bad for the environment. That's bad for global human rights. That's sidebar. Total sidebar.
Sustainable fashion.
Yeah, that's on my next podcast.
Okay.
On slow fashion. Justin, does the spell break? Because for me, the thing that Lindsay is referring to, I find most often happens on Lizzo songs with the way that the words don't always interplay with the music. The music is kind of telling this like optimistic narrative. And I sometimes feel like she's talking over the music rather than rapping or singing with the music. And I think sometimes that disconnect, and maybe this is a mixing issue, I don't know, because it seems very intentional, but I feel like sometimes I'm experiencing those two things almost on different planes. And if I'm allowing myself to kind of go with the music, oftentimes I feel like I can allow myself to feel free and feel loose. But sometimes the talking nature, the kind of like, TED Talk's not quite right, but like the, whether it's spoken word or some kind of just casual moth poetry thing or whatever, sometimes that's where I get lost. Justin, where are you in the kind of spell and spell breaking discourse?
I think you can see a lot of the evidence of that dissonance in reviews, sort of the more optimistic reviews that talk about the album is like so sunny and optimistic and et cetera, et cetera. And it's like, I don't know, like you listen to Break Up Twice or Naked. There are a lot of these songs where I'm like, she's actually pretty anxious. She sounds like a pretty anxious person who's sort of, she's engaging with ideas about self-confidence and self-assurance. But, you know, I don't think Lizzo is this uniformly positive, optimistic person. I think there's, you're right. I think there's, her lyrics are more complicated than the songs are a lot of the time. I agree with that. In terms of when the spell breaks and when it doesn't, Lindsay and I think we're both kitty cats, right? Like, I think we're not immune to pop music. And I don't think either of us are too cynical. I think, like in my review, right, I talked a lot about Chance the Rapper. And if I think about Donnie Trumpet and the Social Experiment, Surf, right? Like that was an album from a few years ago. Marching Band, Sunny. That's a corny album that to this day I will stand by. I love that album. I'll give you 5,000 positive words about Surf. And that's an album for me where the spell never breaks. And it's because that album is sunny and corny in a lot of things, but it's got a lot of texture to it. And I think sometimes, like what you're saying about this dissonance on Special, there's texture to Lizzo's performance and her songwriting a lot of the time. But I do think that when the spell breaks, it's usually about feeling that the production of the album is kind of steamrolling you a little bit. I think that about like Everybody's Gay or To Be Loved, those beats are just so big and obvious. They do almost obviate the personality at the center of the album.
Let's listen to Everybody's Gay for a minute.
Dance the
This is the kind of song you want to hear from Lizzo. I mean, it's the kind of song you want to know in the world is out there, but it also makes a lot of sense in the Lizzo context. But Justin, to your point, there is something, and this is maybe we should talk about Ricky Reed for a second. Ricky Reed, who is in charge of the production on this record and has been a very successful pop producer for many years. There is a tightness, a tautness, and a gloss to what Ricky Reed does. And it's well-suited to Lizzo's sentiments, but I don't always feel that it's well-suited to her voice, like her vocal patterns. Maybe I'm parsing a tiny bit too finely, but I feel like this is the right music for the emotion, but it doesn't always match up. And Justin, you also said something interesting in your review about how Lizzo and Chance are both actually quote-unquote vulgar, is the word you used. I think essentially what you mean is whether they talk about sex or they talk a little freaky, whatever. It's like, it is what it is. No problem with that. But because of their general sunny demeanor and disposition and public positioning, they actually kind of are getting away with more than you'd be thinking from a distance. Do we feel that the music is too bright for the actual complexity of the sentiments that Lizzo's trying to get across here?
Yeah, this actually reminds me of a conversation you and I had once about Doja Cat, right? It's a similar thing where
I was going to bring Doja in. I'm glad.
Yes, we're just heading. All roads lead to Doja Cat.
Yes.
All
right, roads. But it's a similar thing of like, yeah, on the text, right, Doja Cat is freaky. But sometimes music, sometimes the radio transforms Doja Cat into something that sounds a lot safer than it actually is. And that's a purely musical sonic transformation. Like, Lindsay, I'm curious what you think.
I was thinking about Doja when I was writing this review and listening to this record more in terms of like their trajectories seem strangely similar to me. And specifically the way that they both came out in the beginning using like humor and drawing this line between like the humorous viral video or the serious artist. And I think in some ways, both Lizzo and Doja have tried to get out of that comedy meme lane to various degrees, at least in their music, and be taken seriously. I mean, they have both now won Grammys, and they're two artists that came to prominence basically seeming like novelty figures, or Lizzo with, you know, the flute videos. I forget the first one that went, but she, you know, initially she came into a lot of people's consciousness as this sort of meme. And same with Doja Cat. So I think that there is this struggle in some ways, because Lizzo is funny and there's lines on this record that like make me laugh out loud. And her delivery is, she has a really good comic timing. It doesn't always work. And I think there's kind of nothing worse than a punchline on a song that like falls flat. It's, that's the risk you take in employing humor. But that is something that I hear her trying to integrate into her music more explicitly than someone like Doja, who is almost just, I'm going to be funny on the internet and then be super horny and kind of serious in my music. And that's the balance. So I do think they're interesting figures to look at side by side and coming up in a similar moment. I would rather listen to a Doja record than a Lizzo record most of the time. But I'm still trying to figure out exactly why that is. And do they serve similar functions like in the pop firmament right now?
When I think about the kind of extreme positivity, self-love, empowerment narratives, it's funny because y'all were thinking about Doja Cat, Chance. I was actually thinking a lot about Christian pop music, kind of like deeply affirmative pop music that kind of like brooks no dissent. I often enjoy, when I'm traveling, I enjoy listening to like, and I don't want to say like the local Christian pop station, because I think they're all centralized. They're all like Love FM. I think they're all owned by like a Christian conglomerate. Don't fact check me on that, whatever. But like the one thing that I do know is the certainty of those records and the certainty of the affirmation I can find very soothing. And it's interesting because I was thinking about that in relationship to Lizzo and kind of why are those two things? Are those two things different? Is what's attempted to be achieved in Christian pop different than what Lizzo is attempting to achieve? And I think the key difference, and Lindsay, this goes back to what you just said, which is what reminded me of this. Lizzo has not only a sense of humor, but almost like a slight meta-narrative attached to it. She's not just singing affirmation. She's singing about singing affirmation. There's a positionality in it. Whereas in a lot of Christian pop, it's very straightforward. It's just, I'm telling you about love for Jesus, my love for Jesus and what Jesus has done for me. Lizzo is doing a little bit of like a pantomime of that. It's like she means it, but she's also winking at you at the same time, being like, we're all kind of in on this. And I think that was helpful in kind of parsing why I respond to Lizzo a certain way, because I feel like there is that second layer of commentary or humor or meta narrative on top of it. And I don't think it's always evident. It's not always like right at the front, but I do think it's a little bit in the performance. It's a little bit in like where she chooses to deploy her voice more powerfully or less powerfully. I feel like she's picking spots to let you know, I am singing this affirming song, and I am also aware that I am singing this affirming song. Maybe it's cringe, maybe it's not, but you know, we're all in this together. She's doing that. That's how it feels to me after a few listens.
I think to take that a little further too, like she's singing affirming songs about being Lizzo. There's a singular personality at the center of the music. And I think there's also on this record and the last record too, but I think maybe to more extent this one, an assumption that you're going to be familiar about the extracurricular things going on in the world of Lizzo that are not just this record. You know, this opens with her referencing the smoothie controversy that she got quote unquote canceled, but like she uses the word canceled on this record. She's referencing these sort of micro controversies that happened to her on the internet, on Instagram Live, that from the opening moments of the first song. I think a lot of these songs can stand alone and are intended to stand alone as just insert yourself into this affirmative space. But there's really specific things, particularly on the verses of these songs, that I think, John, you were saying how there's this juxtaposition that sometimes feels a little bit like the seams are showing a little bit between the verses and the choruses. The verses often feel like they're these like progress reports on like this is what Lizzo is going through right now, and this is how I'm feeling. And a lot of times where the anxiety is, of this is what I've been through recently, and these are the trials that I've endured. And then the chorus for a song like Special is this really bombastic, big tent. Everybody come in and feel this emotion with me, even though the rest of the song is incredibly specific to being her. A song like Special is a little tough for me because it just feels like it's two different songs stitched together. One of the songs is really a confessional about how she's feeling and what it has been like to be this public figure on the internet for her, courting controversies that might not have stuck to someone who didn't look like her. And then suddenly the chorus comes in and it's this super affirmative thing coming from the same voice and the same perspective. And I guess I don't always know like how we get from A to B with her, how we get from the anxiety to this huge affirmation in a 3-minute pop song. And I'm interested in that anxiety though, because I think, Charity, I think you're right that it's there. And I think that's another thing that sort of ties her with Doja in this way, that you get the sense that these are both sort of anxious people who are very aware of how they're perceived and freaked out by it in some ways, but interested in making art about it. And I'm most interested in the songs on this record where Lizzo's really engaging with that and not just trying to immediately cover it up with the big bombastic celebratory chorus.
Let's listen to a bit of Special, and let's listen to specifically like the transition from a verse to a chorus to kind of hear the difference. Stones, if you ain't been through a pain, that's why we feel so alone. That's why we feel so ashamed. To that point, though, I will say that is part of the Lizzo kind of like worldview, right? Where it's like you may be grappling with internal anxiety. You may be grappling with people being unkind or ungenerous to you. However, there is salvation to be found. There is optimism to be absorbed. Quite literally, the sun will rise again. Like those moments you're describing feel to me like, yeah, it's dark, but the sun is coming. And choosing the sun, even though you're living in the dark, it's you're choosing the sun. We don't really hear, frankly, that much music on like pop radio, certainly, and certainly not these days, you know, in the days of Billie Eilish and whatever. Like, you know, it's like you're not hearing a lot of stuff like this. Justin, is Lizzo too optimistic?
It's not about too optimistic. It's more about, I actually really like that phrase, the Lizzo worldview, right? Like her albums definitely represent, again, there's a sort of, I guess in my review, I talked about it as a progressive gloss, but that I think that gloss sometimes, if you're not the exact target audience of it, and to me, the target audience of Lizzo songs is like James Corden individually, right? If you're, it's sort of, or like Reese Witherspoon, right? But it's like, to me, so Naked, I'll tell you, the song I had the most trouble with listening through the album for review, right, was Naked, because if you take that song, you have any other artist perform that song on any other album. And what is Naked? Well, it's a sex jam. Work through the lyrics of Naked and it's a sex jam. But because it's on Special, an album by Lizzo, and it's filtered through the Lizzo worldview, as you put it, and because it's filtered through that kind of meta affirmation that you're talking about, right? We're singing songs about optimism. You sort of just instinctively understand that Naked is not a sex jam on this album. It's a song about body image.
And self-acceptance, yeah.
Right, but then I get hung up on, well, is that presumptuous of me to say, right? Because again, the text of the song is, this is a sex jam. This is a song, this is a come hither bedroom, play with my body type thing. But you know you're on a Lizzo album, and the Lizzo worldview dictates that what you're actually listening to is a song about body positivity and body image. And I think, like, just to me, that maybe this is getting back to Lindsay's point about when the spell breaks and when it doesn't. It seems to largely hinge on, like, do you buy into, not buy into, because you can sort of understand that her point of view as an artist on her own album, right, is valid, but you either sign up for the Lizzo worldview or you don't. And that really informs how you receive her and her corniness and her song.
Can I offer just a light counterpoint, though? Like, maybe the takeaway from this song, and actually, let's listen to a little bit of Naked on the Lizzo album.
Beauty is a gift, but curses everyone that chases. I wish we could live without nobody expectations. I've seen every part of me, and babe, I can't erase it. If I
could... Maybe the takeaway from the thinking about this song or the commentary in the song is that every prior song that was this song or similar to this song by every prior artist was also a song about body image. It just wasn't received as such because that's not where the discourse was. But that all other kinds of artists have felt completely fine releasing songs like this because the body image and the body image discourse at the time did not apply in those places. Is this not exposing the flaws in how we as critics, fans generally, have thought about music of this kind?
I mean, I think we'd have to call Genuine and ask him to find out.
You got his number? For
Usher. We got Genuine on the line here.
Yeah, surprise.
I think that's an interesting question posed by a listener of the album. I don't actually know that that's a question posed by the music itself, right? I think maybe that's, again, maybe we're sort of getting at what Lizzo could be doing that would maybe help better sell the Lizzo worldview, again, as you put it, to somebody who isn't already bought into it, to make the Lizzo worldview a bit more persuasive than it already is. But again, maybe that's not what she wants to do. Maybe she does just want to find all the optimistic people and make them feel good.
Lindsay, you obviously listened to this record for the review. I'm sure you listened to it in different settings or at different moments. Did you feel differently about it at different, like I felt differently about it this morning? Did you feel differently about it at different moments, different times of day, more exuberant, less exuberant? It reminds me of a conversation I had with Sam Sifton once where I was just like, when he was still food critic, and I was like, you have to go out to eat 7 nights a week every night. What if you want Thai food, but you have to eat at a steakhouse? What if you want sushi, but you're stuck eating in an Italian restaurant? Like, it's not always going to line up with where your desires or your openness is at. Did you have any kind of reaction of the record that kind of functioned that way differently in different settings?
It's strange. I did have the experience of getting some really exciting news while I was reviewing this record.
What better record, theoretically?
And it just didn't really hit
didn't do
for
it.
Me.
Didn't
I
do
don't
it.
Know
didn't
that it's just in that moment, I just wanted to listen to something that I had like more of a history with or like, you know, favorite songs or something. It felt too on the nose for that, I think.
On the nose. A lot of this is on the nose.
Again, you guys are using the phrase like Lizzo worldview. Again, I'm just, here comes the cynic again. But the phrase that I found myself using in the review was personal brand. And I do think, you know, going back to what I was saying about this being music about Lizzo affirming Lizzo, like this is very much music about being Lizzo at the end of the day. And also just going back to the beginning of this conversation of Charity saying, who is this music for and how is it functioning specifically like on social media, on the internet? We've, you know, talked about these lyrics as Instagram captions or as hashtags or something like that, which I do think is really valid. This feels also to me like music about the listener, assuming the listener has this sort of public facing personal brand too, that this is supposed to be the thing you caption the Instagram when you get good news or it's about damn time, you know.
Is that different from Drake?
Which is exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah, is that different from Drake? Is Lizzo just Drake for people who are forward-facing happy, even if they are traumatized
as opposed
and they're
to evil? And
I don't know that Drake is always forward-facing
Drake seems pretty
happy, though.
To be honest, Drake seems pretty content.
I mean, yeah, that's it all comes back to Drake, doesn't it?
Well, sorry.
No, it's fine. I think, okay, here's where I wanted to get with that, is that I think the issue that I have with this record in particular is that I feel the tension of Lizzo wanting to say something that's a little more complicated than the personal brand will allow. I think on a song like Coldplay, can't believe there's a song called Coldplay closing this album.
Oh, I can. But I can. Oh, I definitely can.
It makes sense, but also, yeah.
Yeah, and that song doesn't really work for me, but I like where she's going with it. It feels sonically like it's not really working for me, but the message of the lyrics, I think that is the most anxious song on the record. There's a skittishness to even the musicality of it. But she's talking about, you know, being, she's been this queen of empowerment pop, of like, you don't need a man. There's so many songs about friendship between women on this record. Like half of the songs are about that. I think that's beautiful. But then there's also this very faint strain of her trying to figure out what happens when I'm in a relationship with a man? What happens when I feel vulnerable enough to let my guard down and experience romantic love? And that's really interesting to me, and feels like a way to kind of push forward what she's saying and really explore something personal. I mean, she had a boyfriend reveal recently that was like very cute and sweet, and she's in a relationship now publicly, and you get strains of that on this record, and particularly strains of the really nervous, giddy early stage where she's just like, I've been single and supporting myself for so long. You know, who am I in a relationship? And I think Coldplay is a song that really captures that anxiety and doesn't necessarily know what to do with it musically. But that's a really interesting avenue forward for me in terms of like, what is the next Lizzo record? What is a way that she can push herself a little bit to say something more complex and personal about where she's at now? I feel like there's moments of her trying to do that on this record, and it does not quite get all the way there, but I'd love to hear more of that. That feels interesting to me.
Ricky Reed did an interview with Vulture with Justin Curdo, who's been on Popcast before. What's up, Justin? They talked about that song, and apparently the process of that song was very different than other Lizzo writing sessions, and I hope I'm not butchering it, but basically they had the skeleton of the beat, or they had basically the beat maybe without the sample at the beginning, and Lizzo just kind of went in the booth and talked for 45 minutes, telling a story about the vacation, the walking on the beach, listening to Coldplay. Like that's in the, I mean, I don't know if it's spoken word or just narrative, just telling, you know, like I said, like Moth styled storytelling. And then he sat on it and then chopped that up into effectively what became the verses. And then she came in, listened to that, and recorded them as verses. And it's interesting because I agree, this is maybe the one song on the record that doesn't feel to me like a catchphrase backwards. Like it kind of turned it into that, because it's like, oh, we have the Coldplay thing. Okay, we'll get the sample. Okay, we'll like kind of reverse engineer the Lizzo framework. But it does not feel like that as a song. And I think that's maybe because of the process from which it was extracted. I feel like we have covered a tremendous amount of ground in the Lizzo, whether it's personal brand universe or worldview. I appreciate y'all coming on the journey with me. We should go out listening to Lizzo's Coldplay, but not actual Coldplay. We'll never do that on Popcast. Sorry.
This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at The New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities, to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
A quick second segment this week, and I hope you guys will indulge me. Way back in college, when I didn't really know what I wanted to do, I was writing music reviews for the paper, for the weekly newspaper at school. And in one of my classes, I was assigned to read Text and Act by Richard Taruskin. I'll just be very upfront. I was not at all interested in the subject of what Taruskin was writing about, which is classical music, Russian opera, etc. But the fervor and intensity of the arguments stuck with me at the time and sort of like lived in the back of my head. Taruskin recently passed away, and I want to just talk a little bit about some of his contributions in the field of classical music criticism, but also just critical discourse and how talking about art can infiltrate a broader popular sphere. Joining me, it's Will Robin. Will, how's it going?
Good. Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm happy to have you. Will wrote Taruskin's obituary for the Times. Will is also an associate professor of musicology down at the University of Maryland at College Park. Will, to me, Taruskin was a critical titan. How is he perceived within the world of classical music criticism and discourse?
It's funny you mentioned reading Text and Act in college, because I also read it early in college as an assignment on a class. And I didn't know what to make of it, except I could tell that he was like very angry.
He's on one.
And I was like, who is he fighting with? And then a couple of years later, when I got more into musicology, I came back to it and I was like, oh, I see what this is doing and where he's situating himself in the field and why he's arguing the way he's arguing. But similarly, like when I assign his work now to my students, one of the first things they say is, oh my God, like I didn't know you could be this rawly polemical in an academic publication. And I think that's an important part of his legacy, both because it is related to how successful and brilliant of a writer he was, that he was someone who laid out these incredibly detailed and well-crafted and erudite, but also very funny and insightful, and also sometimes just like straight up mad arguments, but also that those arguments served a purpose in the world of classical music, which is really pushing back against this idea that classical music is this universal canon of self-evident great music, that all we need to do is listen to it and we'll be hooked and its greatness can be heard in the notes themselves. And instead saying like all of these composers and their works were products of specific historical circumstances and contexts and ideologies. And we should hear that in the music. The music can't be divorced from that.
Yeah, that they are products, not simply that the music is a product of the systems of power that were in place at the time, but that the reception is really where what do we perceive as great? What do we perceive as canonical? Those are byproducts of the systems of power and in place in any given time. And obviously, this is an old-fashioned way of saying, can you separate the art from the artist? And of course, what Taruskin was saying is you cannot separate the art from the artist. You cannot separate the art from the social and political context. How radical was that notion in discussing classical music during the time in which he was advocating this idea?
He was part of a real generational shift in the between the 1970s and the 1990s as part of what became known as new musicology, where all kinds of different writers, and Taruskin was one of the most prominent among them, were really showing that this music has these contexts, that it has this politics, and that it has been widely assumed for several hundred years in the world of classical music that Beethoven's kind of at the top of the echelon. And the assumption is, well, his 9 symphonies are really great works. And Taruskin's not saying, you know, these aren't great works. They absolutely are. But he's also saying one of the reasons that a composer like Beethoven has climbed to the top of the heap is because of the way that his music was understood by listeners, which includes not just people in concert halls, but the aristocrats who promoted his music, the music critics who disseminated it. And a lot of those people had agendas that related to, for example, the desire to advance a notion of universally great Austro-German music in the 19th century that related to German nationalism. And that's not a coincidence. And so if we understand these things working together, music and politics, we get a much clearer sense of what music history actually is. And if you go back and read music history textbooks of, let's say, the 1950s, what you often get is, here are the great pieces. Here's a little bit about each composer, you know, their lives, their lovers, how they died. And here's what you should listen for in the piece. And if you read Taruskin's gigantic Oxford History of Western Music, it's the opposite of that. It's, let's look at the music in actually really intensive detail. I mean, there's really incredibly intricate and dense musical analysis, but then we'll understand these notes as not just these creators wrote XYZ because, you know, they were in love with this person or because they were feeling depressed, but because they were part of a specific set of historical circumstances in 1810s Vienna or in 1890s Russia or something like that.
So the Oxford History of Western Music, for those who don't know, this is a 6-volume compendium written entirely by Taruskin, correct?
Yes.
It's interesting because we're talking about his maybe like fundamental skepticism of how canons are built, but there is something to, about being like, I wrote the entire history of this, right? How did he reconcile that? How did he reconcile that, and how was it received when it was released?
The Ox is how it's widely known.
I did not know that. I was happy that your piece said that. I'm now going to refer to it as the Ox.
Yeah, but yes. Great. That's the insider lingo. Yeah. I mean, you know, look, I don't think anyone, including Taruskin himself, would have not said he was not a very arrogant person and that a project like this requires a certain kind of arrogance. And his arguments were so strong because he made them so strongly. You know, I interviewed him for my own podcast a few years ago. And one of the questions I asked him was like, do you ever think you were wrong about all these polemical things that you said? And he said, no, I've never been. Like, I think I've always been right. And that comes from a certain kind of way of thinking about the world.
Damn, Will, even I've been wrong once or twice. Jeez.
But the Oxford History of Western Music is both considered like a landmark that seems unsurpassable in many ways, but was also endlessly critiqued when it came out because it left out all kinds of major composers. Ralph Vaughan Williams only gets a couple pages. I think John Sibelius gets very few mentions. It picks a lot of fights that Taruskin had long been picking, especially he spends a lot of time, especially in the 20th century, talking about the ways in which academic composers like Milton Babbitt or Elliot Carter were very much a product of a certain kind of Cold War era political and ideological system that those composers themselves have vociferously refuted. And then, you know, more recently, I think the big criticism that folks see of the Oxford History of Western Music and that Susan McCleary, who is one of Taruskin's most significant contemporaries and the real kind of spearhead of the new musicology movement in many ways, points out in a long review of Taruskin's work is that it is very much a, despite the kind of radical ways in which he's contextualizing classical music, it takes a very kind of canonized view of what classical music is, or what he calls Western music. So it's primarily focused on this written tradition going back to the medieval era. It's not really addressing popular music. It's not talking about jazz. And this is something that folks pointed out at the time, but I think has only grown to be more clear in how we understand classical music today, that it can't be so easily and neatly cordoned off from a lot of other musical traditions, especially the very rich tradition of African-American music, in which Taruskin really doesn't talk about Black composers really much at all.
The intensity of Taruskin's arguments, and you talk about this in a little bit in your obituary about these kind of big presentations that he would give at conferences, how much did that spill over into the next generation of classical music criticism? People taking big swings. And I actually very vividly remember when I started freelancing for the Times, this would have been in the early 2000s, thinking, Richard Taruskin is writing for the New York Times? That's crazy. Like when I was in the Academy, before I dropped out, when I was in the Academy, I was told, hey, there's a wall here. Like you live on one side of the wall or the other side of the wall, and you cannot be writing really popular stuff. Obviously, I was trying to break that down. But when I saw that Richard Taruskin was doing it in both places, I was like, okay, well, it's open season then. I found it very moving to see an academic writing at that level with that intensity about a subject like classical music in a popular publication. How much did that spill over into the 2000s and the 2010s and how classical music criticism evolved?
Within the world of musicology, which is my wheelhouse, the phrase public musicology comes up a lot in the last decade or so, referring to this idea of academics writing more for the popular press, doing more kind of community outreach. And in many ways, Taruskin was, I think, a pioneer of that. He was not the first musicologist by any means to write for the New York Times, and many have since him. But I think he did so in a way that caused people to really pay attention to these academic arguments, because he was using the language of the polemic to underscore a big academic thing. You mentioned Text and Act, which is this dense academic book, but that book is also primarily essays from the Times that he kind of expanded and edited. He was able to do this thing at the same time, writing these big books for the Academy, but also writing these kind of long form, very witty, erudite, and argumentative things for the Times. That served as a model for a lot of younger musicologists, myself included. And I also think that, you know, the world of classical music criticism and journalism, like, I want to see more of that almost. I think all of us of our generation have read Tereskin and want to do that. And I mean, I know I would personally never feel comfortable saying anything as loudly or proudly as the stuff that he wrote. I don't have that kind of self-assuredness, I think. And I think you do have to operate at a certain kind of, I think, cultural position, but also a certain kind of just like sheer command of the material as well.
You have to remember speaking loudly and with conviction in an era where there was no Twitter, where there was no like public discourse sphere, where you could be immediately called out onto the table, is a very different era. And I think in a weird way, the way that discourse has evolved, there's maybe like 1,000 Richard Tereskins right now, but maybe not working in the same milieu that he worked in, you know, very much a product of his era. We should go out listening to something that Tereskin would have loved. Do you want to pick something?
Yeah, I think Boris Godunov, the opera by the composer Modest Mussorgsky, which Tereskin wrote a lot about and was really a pioneering scholar of Russian opera, which is where his work got started. I think that's probably a good place to leave it.
That is our show. Thank you to Lindsay and Justin, and thank you to Will. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us. podcast@nytimes.com. If you have questions, hell, if you read Text and Act in college, email me. Let's talk about it. Get in the Discord. Hopefully the new link is working for people. tinyurl.com/podcast Discord. Get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcast Facebook. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Google, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. For the first time ever on Popcast, here's a little Mussorgsky.